We have to strike now, sir. Annihilate. Kill. Kill. Kill.
Shut up. Shut the shut up.
Step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert. And welcome to the bunker, everybody. We're starting out the week on an interesting note here.
Yes.
For those of you who are hunting in Bigfoot, the hunt has been called off.
Yes, as we go to press here, Monday, February 27th of 2006, just past 7 o'clock Bunker Standard Time, which of course is 0100 Greenwich Mean Time, comes word that the government of Malaysia, actually the provincial government of the state of Johor in Malaysia, has banned the foreign Bigfoot hunt.
Oh,
I know.
I was just packing.
Foreign film crews coming in from South Korea, the U.S., and Great Britain have been told that if they land in their country, they could be subject to 3 years in jail or a fine of up to $2,500.
Well, I don't know. Maybe they just either want to keep Bigfoot hidden or they just don't want the international press. Because according to the story on Watcher Magazine, there's been a spate of sightings.
A spate!
A spate, I tell you.
Yeah, well, I think they just want to make sure that Malaysians are the first ones to find him. They don't
want some
hotshot American coming over there with a camera.
Besides, he's not in season right now.
That's right. As you remember, we mentioned last week that a group in Malaysia, in the state of Johor, has announced that they found a colony of these critters ranging from, well, the juveniles are 7 to 8 feet tall, to the adults ranging from 10 to 12 feet in height, and that they plan to announce and present their evidence for this soon. But as soon as they made that announcement, of course, film crews from all over the world, South Korea, Britain, the U.S., elsewhere, announced that they were going to rush into Malaysia to document it. And so apparently the state of Johor has announced that no foreigners need apply.
Well, you know, it's understandable, especially when word got there that Dick Cheney was on his way.
That's a good one.
Thanks, honey. Hey, speaking of Cheney.
Yeah?
Who's connected to Halliburton.
Yeah.
Pop.
Oh, that's a very good segue there.
Thank you.
We've been talking about depleted uranium, and we will spend a good chunk of this week talking about the depleted uranium story as we begin a three-part interview with Carl W. B. Schwartz tomorrow. Technically tomorrow, although we won't upload the story to the internet until after midnight local time.
So technically it's Wednesday morning.
So technically it'll be Wednesday morning by the time you hear it.
But Bunker Standard Time, well,
yes.
You know.
Yeah, we're on the global internet time. We've got, you know, we have a global reach here.
Yeah. We do.
It's like shaped like a claw.
It's like that boarding house reach. Give me that butter.
So, where were we? Depleted uranium, yes.
Yes. Halliburton.
Lurin Moret, who's written extensively about depleted uranium. In fact, we cited a story of hers from last week, which laid the blame for Gulf War syndrome on depleted uranium.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a story that we've got on the front of Watcher magazine tonight about the detectors at the atomic weapons establishment in England, which picked up the spike in radioactivity, mm-hmm. which followed the attack in Afghanistan at Tora Bora. And so that was where Osama bin Laden snuck out and got into Pakistan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where Geraldo was ducking the phantom bullets. That was Tora Bora. And then the shock and awe attack at in Baghdad in 2003. Readings up to four times normal, the highest ever recorded in England, were detected. But what was interesting and what I didn't pick up on, and Carl Schwartz may have mentioned this, because I'm sure this didn't escape Carl's attention.
You wouldn't think so. He was very thorough.
That the atomic weapons establishment, in order to notify the public of any issues that might arise, any emergencies at the weapons testing and development facility at Aldermaston, put up these detectors around the facility to check for any radiation leaks. Well, 3 years ago, in 2003, just prior to our invasion of Iraq, the monitoring of radioactivity, these detectors, the operation of these detectors was taken over by Halliburton.
Shock and awe.
Isn't that interesting? And when Dr. Busby, who published the report, which we linked to the PDF file last week, when Dr. Busby requested the data, the readouts, under British law, Halliburton refused to release the information, which was in violation of English law. So it wasn't until Dr. Busby went to the Ministry of Defense that the information was released. Or actually, when the information was released, the data from 2003 was missing. And it was the 2003 data, the stuff that showed the spike 8-9 weeks after the attack in Baghdad, that was released by the Defense Procurement Agency in England.
So, and I think that that shows that the Ministry of Defense was very interested in that data.
Yes. And also shows that Halliburton knew that there was something about that data that they didn't want going public.
Yep.
So that was a very interesting little piece of that story. And again, we encourage you to read that article and be listening as we talk to Carl Schwartz. It's an interview that we recorded a little over a week ago. But because they were going to time the release of this interview with the release of Dr. Busby's report, which was leaked to the British press a week ago, we had agreed to hold the interview until Wednesday morning, when the report will be delivered at a press conference on the steps of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta.
This DU story, I really pray that it keeps going and going, that someone keeps this alive, because it's, I think it's clear that somebody wants it buried, and you can understand why when you look at how horrifying it is that we're using this and people are dying.
Right. Again, let's go back to the statistics for the number of American servicemen and women who are on permanent disability, those who served in Gulf War I back in 91. Over 56% are now on permanent disability. Now, you would assume that most of those people would be in their 30s and 40s. Physically, they should be in pretty good shape.
Right.
Again, especially because in the military, you've got to go through a lot of PT, physical training. Those people tend to be in better shape than the rest of the average American population.
Right.
And over 56% of them are now on permanent disability, unable to work because of what they were exposed to during the Gulf War.
And then you have to factor in those who are having, you know, difficulty just coping with daily life, but don't qualify for permanent disability.
Yeah, not everyone who applies is accepted. So, right, that number of people who are suffering is probably higher than the, the percentage of people is probably higher than at 56%.
Right.
So, well, as long as we're in Iraq, there was a very interesting message that sort of was sent out through the Turkish press by the Prime Minister of Turkey today. He said in an interview Sunday that the wave of violence in Iraq between Sunni and Shiite Muslims were provocation. He does not believe, he says, that Sunnis staged the attacks as reprisal, or, well, blew up the dome, the Golden Dome there in Samarra.
What, he thinks a third party did this?
That is what he is saying.
Someone posing as Sunnis?
He thinks somebody is trying to provoke a civil war in Iraq. And my take on this, and tell me if you think I'm getting a little too conspiratorial here, is that this is...
What's that shiny thing on your head?
Yeah, it's my foil hat. I thought I had it hidden. I think this is his way of letting it be known to the West, America in particular, that he's not buying the official story.
You know, we've had a couple of leaks now out of Turkey. The story about, who was it who was over in Turkey basically preparing everybody for, it was Chertoff who came over and wasn't it Chertoff who came over and said we're going to be coming in?
No, it wasn't Department of Homeland Security. It wasn't Chertoff. It was somebody else in the administration who was...
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that right now.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that too.
I'm sitting here literally with a pen drawing a blank. But I know that Turkey has not always been well, crazy about the way we handle things there in Iraq.
Right.
And, of course, everybody remembers that just before we went in, Turkey had originally, southern Turkey, which, of course, borders Iraq, was going to be a staging ground. And at the last minute, they said no.
They're not crazy about the idea of the Kurds on their southern border joining with the Kurds in northern Iraq and forming an independent Kurdistan.
Exactly.
Which they could, if given the chance, because that would encompass the oil-producing area in the north of Mosul, and they would be able to finance, you know, an independent nation state there. And the
exactly,
Turks aren't crazy about that idea.
We need to remember once again that Iraq is a fake state.
Yeah, it was basically cobbled together after World War One. Just arbitrary, almost arbitrary lines drawn on a map, and tribal loyalties have a lot more to do with. Are a lot stronger than national loyalty in Iraq. And anyone who doesn't understand that, and we as Westerners don't really grasp this as strongly as we could. We're trying to, but the fact is that you've got sectarian loyalty there, Sunni, Shia, and then you've got, of course, the tribal loyalties. And boy, those break down so many different ways. I don't have a clue. I am totally ignorant when it comes to how those break down. But I guarantee that it makes for very fractionalized politics.
Yeah.
And when the English and the British, after World War One, World War II, cobbled together the Middle East, they didn't pay any attention to tribal boundaries, tribal lands. And they just jammed them all together. And basically it wound up with whoever had the most guns and could make the most outside friends to supply them with guns wound up in charge.
Yeah, well, it's the same kind of thing that's been going on in Eastern Europe for a long time. You know, whoever comes out the winner in World War II or wherever, well, see, you be in this country, you over here, you be in this country, you be on this side of the wall, you be on that side of the wall.
Right.
It's as if they came through our neighborhood, if there were some kind of a ruckus in our neighborhood, and they said, okay, the dividing line is right down the middle of Derbyshire Street.
Yeah.
I know you guys have been friends and neighbors for years, but you're now enemies.
Yeah, it's a mess there, and things are degenerating. The New York Times, very interestingly, printed an article briefly on Friday for about an hour, which quoted our envoy to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's been heavily involved in what's gone on in Afghanistan going back to the Clinton administration, behind the scenes, very quietly. And he was quoted in the New York Times, which basically summarized his statement to say that if we don't get a handle on things in a hurry, it's going to devolve into a civil war. And then about an hour later, the story was yanked, and then it was put back up later in the day, but it was rephrased to say that if we don't get a handle on it, it could threaten future stabilization, which I guess is a nicer way of saying it, phrasing things, than saying we're on the edge of a civil war. But frankly, other observers there have said that we are already having a low-grade civil war, and that already inside Baghdad, groups of people are moving to areas in which their sect, Sunni or Shia, are in the majority, and they're finding that the only way they can get protection, some people, are by turning to these armed gangs.
Oh, yeah. You know, at the time that a quote-unquote war is beginning, it's not clear that it started.
Right.
I mean, people don't generally say, oh, well, there you go, war started today.
Yeah.
It's just sort of an escalation, you know, 1 degree hotter every day. It's only later on when historians look back and they go, okay, well, it started here. It started when they shot this archduke.
yeah. It's not, well, I mean, things seem to be a little quieter today.
Yeah.
And we pray that that continues.
Yeah.
But the fact is that we went in there with the idea that we were going to be greeted with flowers and sweets as the rescuers of the people of Iraq from the tyrant Saddam Hussein. Now, I don't know if the people in Washington, D.C. really believed that or if they were just flat-out naive. Either way, that was the way it was sold to the American people. And I think as the realization grows that that's not happening and that they may be shooting at each other today but could just as easily turn and you know, resume shooting on our troops there again tomorrow.
Right.
I think that mom-and-pop middle America who proudly sent son and daughter off to serve in the interest of spreading the blessings that we have in terms of liberty, you know, around the world. I think that support for this war is going to dry up in a big hurry.
Well, you know, along that same line, I saw a very interesting interview today, and I wish I could remember the name of the gentleman who is being interviewed, because he is a Republican spokesman, writer, studies politics and trends.
Mm-hmm.
He is, I think he considers himself an expert on Nixon,
mm-hmm.
and how Nixon turned things around from his defeat against Kennedy and then eventually became president. Now, we'll ignore what happened after that, but he did become president. He was being interviewed by Cavuto today,
mm-hmm.
and the question was, is Al Gore the next Nixon? In other words, this man who is an expert on Nixon's maneuverings,
mm-hmm.
and his remaking of himself has been taking a look at Al Gore, and even though he is a Republican,
mm-hmm.
he says he admires and respects what Gore is doing. He believes Gore is making all the right moves. He is redefining himself. He is aligning himself with the anti-war movement.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon did the same thing. He backed Goldwater, anti-war. Gore is doing a very similar thing right now. He's out there. I don't like how he's doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm betting that a lot of people in the Democrat Party who have to vote for in the primaries like what he's doing.
Yeah, that's true.
So if Gore comes up against Hillary,
it could make for a very interesting primary season.
Yeah, I'd like to see a pie fight personally.
That would be entertaining. I could go for that.
Yeah.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Sadly, on the Republican side, the choice seems to be, at least in terms of where do we go from here, either committing more troops or cutting and running. And neither option right now seems to be very viable.
No, and I think that's why Hillary's very hawkish.
Yeah. And she, well, as we've said before, she sounds more hawkish than GW does on a lot of days,
yeah.
President Bush. But one of the more influential neocons was interviewed over the weekend on Fox News Sunday by Chris Wallace, Bill Kristol, who is, what's his paper? Not National Review, Weekly Standard.
Weekly Standard,
yeah.
Yes.
Bill Kristol, of course, his father, Irving Kristol, was like, you know, one of the godfathers of the whole neocon
mm-hmm.
movement.
Bill Kristol, PNAC.
Right. Bill Kristol's connected
for
to PNAC.
Century.
And he's, of course, a Fox News contributor while at the same time writing all of these, you know, pro neocon pieces for,
mm-hmm.
Op-eds for his magazine. And of course, his publication, like Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch. He has come out and said the reason that we are having such trouble in Iraq right now is because we haven't been tough enough. Quoting from the transcript of his interview with Chris Wallace, he said, there would not be civil war if Zarqawi had not spent the last 2.5 years, had ex-Saddamists with him very skillfully going on the offensive, slaughtering Shia in Karbala, and now blowing up the mosque. Chris Wallace responds, they're there. There are going to be more mosques to blow up. What do you do about the terrorists? Kristol, kill them. Defeat them. Chris Wallace says, we've been trying. Kristol responds, we've been trying and our soldiers are doing terrifically, but we have not had a serious 3-year effort to fight a war in Iraq as opposed to laying the preconditions for getting out. End quote. In other words, Rumsfeld is too soft, and that's
mm-hmm.
the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned when I read that.
You know, and you should have been stunned, because the truth is Bill Kristol comes off like a mild-mannered, you know, likable, jovial guy when he's speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Very intelligent, but he has serious power. When he writes a letter to somebody, mm-hmm. they pay attention.
Right. He and his father Irving and the group of thinkers that are around them do carry a lot of influence in the thoughts that they express. They may appear on Fox News as commentators, but behind the scenes, they are very influential
yep.
in framing the debate, and have been for quite some time. So when he comes out and says, the reason we're having trouble in Iraq right now is because we've been too soft on these guys. We've been too worried about trying to figure out how to get out instead of winning the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really bothers me, because that indicates how they're going to view the situation with Iran.
He's watched Rod Steiger in Mars.
That's right.
Way too many times.
Kill, kill, annihilate, annihilate. That's the impression I got in reading this transcript. It, you know, I have to say this. Something has always creeped me out about Bill Kristol watching
me too.
Mock TV.
I know it. Me too.
Because you're right. He comes across as a mild-mannered, very intelligent and, mm-hmm. and thoughtful spokesman. But then he comes out with statements like this.
I know.
We need to go in and just obliterate them. Wow. Whoa. Wait.
What?
There are a lot of... And I'm not crazy about the idea that somebody would love to blow me up either.
No.
And frankly, there are certain extremist sects of Islam that hold that that would be a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are a lot of people over there, just as there are here in America, and everywhere in the world, we just like to live our lives, raise our children in peace.
Yes.
Now, we realize that there are times when you got to fight, and I have no problem with that. But to just make a blanket statement like that makes me wonder if Mr. Kristol really has a serious understanding of what going to war is all about.
Mm-hmm.
I have my doubts.
I do, too. Well, we're going to take a total turn to the left.
Oh.
Just a jump to the left.
He's going to burn.
And, well, let's do the time warp again. And we got to go back to mainland France.
Well,
where they've got a few mosquito-borne disease victims.
Oh, we're talking this chikungunya fever.
Chikungunya. This is something that started out about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
This
sounds like something you'd buy, you know, in a little bowl on Bourbon Street.
It does. Chikungunya, yeah. You want that with or without crawfish.
Yeah.
This disease is not generally fatal, but some people have started dying from it, and I think that's sort of surprising people. What gets me is the rapidly escalating infection rate.
Mm-hmm.
The island of Reunion and now Mauritius.
Mm-hmm.
These are in the Indian Ocean. I found a story today that I couldn't get to load.
Mm, okay.
So that's why it's not posted at Watcher. I saw the reference to it. I could not get the page to load, and I couldn't find another source for it. It was a legitimate newspaper, but it wouldn't load.
Mm.
About a story of infections in India itself. These are probably, like in France, people who have vacationed
right
on these islands.
These islands are off the southeast coast of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you can picture, you know, the island of Madagascar off there, off the coast there, and these islands are sort of little satellites a little further out into the ocean.
Right.
And very popular vacation spots for people from France.
This is an insidious disease, and it is not getting any press that I can tell.
No.
Over here. You have to go to alternate sources.
Mm-hmm.
To find these stories. And
overseas.
I mean, Reuters is reporting it. It's not like it's, mm-hmm. you know, just, you know, some little anecdotal evidence from Grandma so-and-so who,
right.
who is writing to her cousin. No, these are our mainline agencies that are reporting it, but it's not being picked up by the big media.
Right. And that's really surprising because the adjectives usually attached to this particular disease are words like crippling, extremely painful,
mm-hmm.
No known cure or
right.
vaccine. It's a disease that is now infected 20% of the population of the island of Reunion,
mm-hmm.
which is about 157,000 people. And again, as Sharon mentioned, it's not normally fatal, but about 77 people have died from this particular strain for some reason. And the worry is that this is going to spread, well, not only to so-called, you know, industrialized, quote-unquote,
right.
countries like France, which it already has, but that it's going to get to the island of Madagascar, which has a very poor health infrastructure. And once it gets there, it could provide a reservoir for this disease for years.
Yeah.
And it is, well, it basically causes extreme joint inflammation and pain. And you just have to let it run its course. There is no cure.
Mm-hmm.
So the disease is spreading more rapidly than it ever has in history.
Yeah, and I don't understand why at the very least... Oh, I'm sorry, honey. I'm sorry to step on your...
Well, no, it's just very bizarre that, as you say, nobody's paying attention to it.
Yeah, I don't understand why at the very least someone doing a little fluff travel piece doesn't say, oh, and by the way, you might want to reconsider your trip to Reunion or Mauritius this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because... At least on Fox News, they're too busy talking about what a great time they're having down in Nolens.
looking for Bigfoot over Malaysia.
As we prepare for Mardi Gras Fat Tuesday, it seems that they've got reporters live on the scene to show you what... Look, it's very simple to tell you what's going on in New Orleans right now. A bunch of idiots are getting drunk and stupid. That's it. That is the...
In fact, the catchphrase is party this month. Sleep it off next month, because, of course, it's the 28th and March 1st.
Right. And when I was young and stupid, I went down to New Orleans. I've attended two Mardi Gras
when
celebrations.
You were 17.
That's about right. I slept on the floor of one of the fraternity houses at Tulane University with a group of other fraternity brothers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. You know how we got down there? We went to one guy who had this old Plymouth Fury. You know, Grand Fury.
Uh-huh.
You know, huge.
Yeah.
Like whale-sized.
Yeah.
He said, if you can make it run, you can borrow it. And we drove from central Illinois to New Orleans with a car that we were able to make run.
Oh, that's frightening.
Yeah, it is frightening. Well,
especially when you got down there that you probably weren't sober the whole time. So.
That is, we didn't.
Because you were young and stupid.
We didn't drive while we were down there, but.
That's good.
Yeah. But
so you weren't very stupid.
But you're right. I mean, it is. There's really nothing to talk about. Now, I realize that New Orleans is in the public eye because of Katrina this year, but I would, as we've talked before, I would like to think that there'd be some people with some common sense down there that said, let's, I mean, you know, 60% of the people in New Orleans are still, what, scattered around the country?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that? I could be wrong. It's like 2 million people from the New Orleans area are still elsewhere.
Well, right.
And yet they're focusing on these idiots getting naked on Bourbon Street.
Yeah.
It just really bothers me.
And there are people sleeping in tents in their front yard in a house that is demolished or going to be demolished that they're still paying a mortgage on.
Right.
And they have nowhere to go.
Right. And Fox News, we're not meaning to pick on Fox because we just don't watch the other channels that often, but what we've seen, you know, our limited exposure to the news has been through Fox. And the slant of the story is, hey, this is great. The city is healing. We're all down here having a great time. They're not doing anything constructive. They're just getting drunk and stupid.
No.
So, you know, spend the news on something worth telling us.
Yeah, I think so.
That would be an improvement.
I know.
Tell us about the Bigfoot in Malaysia.
Well, for those of you who wonder what's underneath Cairo, we now know. It's an ancient temple to the sun. And how it's been under there all this time, and no one in that marketplace was aware of it.
Well, it's because as Cairo expanded, they weren't aware that the ancient holy city of, what is it, Heliopolis?
Heliopolis.
Which is where they had the temples to the Aeneid, the nine principal gods of Egypt.
Yes, and isn't it interesting that this is what I find so interesting about the story. You and I have been reading about the Aeneid and the nine.
Mm-hmm.
And having talked with Peter Lavenda, we really got into that. And we've been reading many books on it and trying to learn more. And lo and behold, what story comes out?
Yeah, Dr.
With Zahi Hawass.
Zahi Hawass. That is an interesting story. And the timing of this, too, I'm sure is significant, although I don't know quite yet what. I've got to do some networking. But, Zahi Hawass is an interesting fellow who is not only in charge of the Giza Plateau, which, of course, is where the Great Pyramid is located. He's in charge of the Supreme Council of Antiquities. He's the grand poobah of everything old in Egypt.
He is.
So whenever they make an announcement there, he's in charge of it. He's controlled it.
And he's got a cool hat.
He does have a cool hat. It's very similar to mine.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
Nicole
picked
that one out.
You look better in the hat.
He's got a better tan, though. Of course, when you're outside in the sun working like he does.
Yeah, well.
But no, he's very intelligent. There's no question. He knows his stuff. But he does have a very particular view of ancient Egyptian history. And it is significant that his schooling was paid for, and he regularly contributes to and addresses the ARE, which is the foundation that was set up back in the 1930s by Edgar Cayce.
Right.
Who was a high-ranking Freemason, and whose prophecies seem
well,
to have
Well,
that
been, isn't proven. It's assumed he was a high-ranking Freemason
well, he and his
based
dad,
on his behavior.
Sure. He and his
right.
father went around setting up lodges. You
exactly.
don't get to do that unless you're...
Well, exactly. I mean, I don't know that there's a paper trail.
No.
But the behavior trail, mm-hmm. definitely, you know, yeah, I think that you can make that assumption.
So anyway, they found a couple of statues that they believe to be Ramses the Great, which is interesting. And also interesting because we can segue right from this into the Masonic pyramid logo of an organization that we thought was dead but is still alive.
I know.
Total Information Awareness.
TIA.
Yes.
Little TIA.
Yeah, or the Information Awareness Office, which is even more interesting because that's the name of one of the gods that was conjured by Aleister Crowley in his Gnostic Mass.
Ah.
Isn't that bizarre? You think somebody would have known that. It's like, let's design this logo that's got the pyramid with the glowing eye and the beams of light coming from the eye overshadowing the whole earth. Yeah, that must have been like an inside joke when they developed this organization. Information Awareness Office, Total Information Awareness, if you're not familiar with this program, it was developed by DARPA, the research agency inside the Defense Department,
mm-hmm.
as a way of data mining.
Mm-hmm. And John Poindexter was put in charge.
John Poindexter, late of Iran-Contra.
Yes.
Yeah, he was in charge of developing this. Total Information Awareness sifted through credit card information. Well, if you've seen the Mel Gibson movie, Conspiracy Theory, where they basically are tracking purchases everywhere. They're mm-hmm. watching for people who are buying mm-hmm. Catcher in the Rye.
Library activity,
credit card use, cell phone calls, magazine subscriptions, everything. Basically, mm-hmm. they sift through all of this, and the idea is to look for patterns that would indicate behavior consistent with a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like doing profiling, but based on the contact that each of us has with the public every day. And we leave so many traces, electronic traces, paper traces every day. There's, you know, you can't really hide unless you really work at it in this society. Well, Congress got a little upset about this 2 years ago and decided to cut off funding for Total Information Awareness. Said, no, we have some serious issues with the privacy, the invasion of privacy that this program represents, the threat mm-hmm. to privacy. Well, they just moved it to a black budget, and a story came out in the National Journal over the weekend. So we posted that, and we'll post the logo in the show notes as well, so you can see what this is about. But that logo, that is so Illuminati, so Freemason, that it had to be an inside joke in the department. Because
do you think they sell T-shirts?
There is. Somebody set up a cafe press store with this logo on it. So you can buy T-shirts.
Excellent.
Actually, we should probably, you know, modify that and you know, make it our logo or something. Because that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Peering into darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah. With, like, sunglasses on the eye or something.
That'd be really cool.
Yeah.
Future's so bright, we got to wear shades.
Yeah, we've got some very, very creative people, graphically creative, on and many other ways creative, on the Peering into Darkness forum. So we'll leave that job to you.
Yeah. But the point of all this is that even when they tell you they're not spying on you, they're spying on you. Because this program was defunded by Congress 2 years ago. And it's still in operation.
Well, that's okay. Hey.
But it's all in the name of fighting terrorism, so it's okay.
$40,000 toilet makes sense to me.
Yeah. So, and again, all of this is just kind of going whoosh.
Yep.
Right over the heads.
I know it is.
But not you, PIDcast listener, because you are informed.
They, you know, we've got the best listeners in the world. They are informed.
We truly do.
Well, you know what? We're running out of time, but we do want to, we've got one prayer request for everybody. We mentioned on the last show that we had, or maybe it was a couple of shows ago, that we had a brand new friend for Murphy.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that just about every PIDcast. She was kind of like biting on things.
Yes, little Java is part of our family. She has been diagnosed with parvovirus, and that is a very aggressive, sadly, all too often fatal virus that can affect very young puppies.
Comes on very quickly.
Yeah, she's about 9.5 weeks old, and apparently she was exposed to it just, you know, prior to the day that we bought her. And she got sick on Saturday morning.
Mm-hmm.
So she was sick all weekend. I was at the door when they unlocked this morning. I called, actually, the vet on Saturday morning and described the symptoms. At that point, she was just barely sick at all. She mm-hmm. just wasn't acting right. And they said, oh, well, she probably ate something that upset her tummy. So anyway, she was diagnosed today with parvo. She is at the vet. She's been kept there. They're going to hospitalize her there for the next few days. So keep her in prayer.
Yeah, because, again, this is something that's it's really insidious. And, well, it's a toss-up.
She is a little scrapper.
Well, she is. I mean, as ill as she was feeling yesterday, she still gave the stuffed frog what for.
Yeah, she was good. She really was trying to mm-hmm. play, even though she hadn't eaten anything for 24 hours and
right.
she didn't want to drink anything. But they told me this afternoon when I called that she was actually eating. I mean, they had to, you know, use a syringe to put it down her throat, but she was swallowing it, wasn't complaining, was not spitting it back up, was mm-hmm. able to keep it down, which is really, you know, that's progress.
Mm-hmm.
So they're aggressively fighting this thing, and she's got a little, well, she was 3 pounds as of last Wednesday. She's lost weight, so I'm not really sure what her weight is now, but, you know, she's a little 2.5 pound, maybe, scrapper.
Yeah. So your prayers will be very much appreciated. In the meanwhile, be listening tomorrow as if you're up late, otherwise early Wednesday morning, as we present the first part of our interview with Carl Schwartz regarding the depleted uranium study and news. We'll also have some links to some other interviews where you can hear Carl and other speakers talking about this as March 1st approaches. They really want to take this story and push it from the so-called alternative media into the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. And if you want to join the forum, it's peeringintodarkness.com/forum, and write to us at radio@peeringintodarkness. You know what? We're running long, so we better go. I'm Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye, everybody.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear, a better day.